Netflix documentary, we didn't see the seven other people asking difficult questions. We just saw you.
No, there wasn't seven different people, unfortunately. It was just me.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Verge Alternative F1 podcast. We have reached episode 8. I can't believe it. We've lasted. We haven't killed each other yet. Guys, how are you? I'm here with my normal band of merry men, Sir Sam Wilson and Matthew Connell.
Yeah, I'm good, man. I mean, the only reason we haven't killed each other is because we can't go anywhere near each other for a main reason. I'm good, mate. I mean, I'd be close, right? I'd be.
I've got to see what's to come now.
If I'm going to be honest, I have fully mellowed out at this point. I'm just like, if anything's going to go wrong, it's probably going to go wrong. So just give up worrying too much.
You've got to do some drugs testing in this one, I'll tell you. How are you, Matt? You good?
Doing good, of course. We have, been blessed with, I think we're doing good. I think we're doing well for ourselves, considering we've managed 8 episodes. Obviously, the first episode we ever did was filmed out of the Shard with us all together by week 2. Okay, coronavirus, here we
are. Starting off big.
A lot of e-races down the line, and here we are with our second guest.
Well, now we're rolling with the big boys. Now I know we're doing well, because now we have got officially, now we're on top level now. Because we've got F1 correspondent for The Sun, Ben Hunt. How are you, sir? And thank you for your time and thanks for joining us.
That's very kind of you. That's good billing. I like that. I'm very good. Thanks, mate. I'm doing all right.
So
we can send you an audio clip if you want of that one, Ben, so you can hear.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to walk around being your hype man everywhere you go. Now, mate,
it's the nicest thing that anyone said anything about me.
Don't worry, we're going to get into all of that. Don't worry about that. So basically, what we want to do is, as obviously, as I hope you've been watching the shows. I know you have. We basically are just fans of the show who happen to work in media, but obviously we want to, luckily enough, to be able to put together a nice program that actually reflects something for the fans, by the fans, but we're not all tech heads, because if we open up a bonnet, none of us know exactly what we're looking at. So, on that,
I can tell you where the water, like the window washing fluid is.
I could do a mean petrol pump. That's what I can do.
Oh, yeah. I can clean the oil dipstick. That's easy.
So now I need you to put us all to shame, Ben. So where did you actually make your start in journalism? Like, was it in sports straight away? What led you into Formula One?
You want to start at the start?
Yeah, let's go from the start. Oh, well, not from birth, but we're just, career-wise.
Top, if we go to the top, I was a frustrated footballer as a 7-year-old. I love football. I'm a Wimbledon fan, and I really wanted to get into playing football, but it never happened. I knew I wasn't good enough, even at that sort of time, and I wanted to work in football. And what I enjoyed doing at school was writing. I enjoyed English. So I wrote a letter as a 7-year-old boy to the Daily Mail, which my mum and dad used to buy at the time, and got through to the editor, sports editor, and he said, to be a sports journalist, this is what you need to do. He replied back. So it was go to university, get a degree, then get a postgrad, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of followed that all the way through. I went to university, did a postgrad in journalism, and then I started working for an agency, which is... for anyone who doesn't know what it is, basically you are the lowest of the low. You go to a football match, usually in non-league, which is where I started, but you work for different newspapers. So you might have 3 or 4 different orders. You go along, you watch the game. The game's the same, but you have different outlets that you're working for. So you have to produce multiple reports for different readers. That taught me a lot. I went from one agency to another. I worked for every single national newspaper in the UK in some capacity, had bylines with them all. I started doing shifts at the Mirror. I started doing shifts at the Sun, and I was at the Sun a few years, working on their desk and doing football matches. And then I was offered the chance in 2012 to go and do F1. I was always an F1 fan. I was a football fan first. But of course, if someone offers you a job to travel the world, get your expenses paid and go and watch some F1, of course you're going to take it. So that's what I did, and I've been doing it. I thought I'd be in it for a couple of years, but of course, what, nine seasons now down the line. So, I'm really enjoying it. Glad I went that way. It's good.
Living that life.
Yeah, mate, that is a life that I'd want to live. I'm not going to lie. so you've been a Formula One fan since you were young. I know you said football first, but you've loved Formula One. Yeah. Yeah. Did you kind of, like, what first and foremost, what was your first race? And, like, who's your team? We got to get that out of the way. Who's your team?
What? People ask about this. What F1 team? If you're talking about what team I follow, I work with all of them. So I do have to sort of be, you know, unbiased in that opinion.
Of course, everyone has to be unbiased. But when you're a kid, who did you follow?
Think it's difficult certainly my era when I was growing up, it was sort of Damon Hill and Williams, and seeing that livery, more so the Williams livery, I think, because it was blue and had gold in it. I think as a Wimbledon fan, I was kind of drawn more to that than the McLaren. So I think, you know, as a kid, probably, the Williams livery, Williams team. I've never really thought about it, to be honest, but it was that car, the Rothmans one is what I'm talking about, how iconic that is. And of course, for me, Senna's passing has just gone by, and I remember, I mean, I'm old enough to remember that and where I was. And funny enough, I was at my dad's place of work, which was The Guardian, the newspaper, and I was in there, and the news started coming through about the fact that he could have died. A very dark day, and I remember it so clearly. You know, it's interesting just to look back and think about it. And, well, sad day.
Yeah, I mean, I was a Damon Hill fan as well, if I'm honest. He used to, because I'm from Bourne, where the BRM factory is.
Okay.
So obviously, he used to come down to the Memorial Day, because obviously his dad was quite a big part of it. So, but it's interesting to see that Williams actually, because I like that Williams car, that Rothmans. I was more of a McLaren, kind of white and red, but Williams had the active suspension as well, so I do know that bit about cars. There we go. In terms of your first experience, so you said you were with your dad at The Guardian when Senna died.
Yeah.
What was, did you ever do any work experience? Did you ever... I'm assuming if your dad wrote for the Guardian, you kind of had a foray into journalism.
No, I didn't. I didn't have a leg up or anything. There was none of that. He was absolutely not involved in the writing side. He was the old liner type. The actual hot metal presses is what he was on that side of the business. So, you know, that was nothing to do with what I wanted to get into. He had a friend whose son was a journalist, and my dad told me a story, and this is one of the ones I remember as a kid. He said that he always had a suitcase packed, ready to go. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, that sounds like world cool. Like, you know, never know where you're going to be. And whenever the phone went, he just went. And like, that's essentially what I do now. I do have a suitcase, which is always half full, toiletries bag already done, ready to go, because literally the phone does go. And sometimes they are mad things, you know, like, you know, can you go to France tomorrow? There's a thing that I had to do once with Ian Poulter, to fly all the way to France, all through Paris traffic. And I had sort of 10 minutes, I think, with him for an interview with EA Sports. And we flew away back. And it was just like, wow, that's just like mind-boggling. You know, in what sort of world does this exist? But, of course, this is what journalism's about. And, you know, getting sent to these things. And the unpredictability is what I really, really enjoy about my job. Not only going to the sporting events, I mean, that's obviously, you know, the big draw, but it's the unpredictability of not knowing what tomorrow brings. And, you know, if you are thinking about being a journalist, you have to have an understanding family, and sort of my wife's very understanding, and my kids are as well, because, you know, literally anything can happen, and then you've got to be prepared. You know, let's bring it back to F1. When Nico Rosberg retired, I was out shopping. I was on a day off, and I had a telephone call saying, Ben, Nico Rosberg's retired. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And he goes, no, he's retired. And I'm like, because no one saw it coming. There was no way that you could have gotten a heads up on that story. The way that he did it was brilliant. And you know, it caught us all cold. And of course, then I had to scramble home quickly and do some work. It was one of those things. But that's what I love about it, you know?
Yeah. So do you, when you were saying that your kids are quite understanding, you said your son that's 8, who's running 5Ks with at the moment. Has he gone towards football, or has he gone towards Formula One?
Mario Kart. Could we call it Mario Kart?
I'm going to take that as Formula One then. All right, yeah. Cool.
He likes racing. He has been to
She's not been to a Formula One race. She's been to World Endurance. We've been to W Series. We've done Banger Stock Car, that sort of stuff. But I haven't taken, I'm just trying to think if I have. Well, I haven't taken him to an F1 race. That's for Hademy, isn't it? But
he's, then you've got an excuse. Dad's always working.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we obviously the British Grand Prix is always a really busy one for me, but I tend to, you know, any tickets that I do get, I give them to people who I know are really going to appreciate them, you know, sort of once in a lifetime opportunity. And Teddy's pretty lucky. He does get to go to quite a few events with me. So I think maybe this year, if it's on, well, it's behind closed doors, we won't be going to that. Maybe next year. You know, it's a thing that he's old enough now to enjoy and to, you know, really enjoy that experience. When I took him to the World Endurance Championship, the WEC thing at Silverstone, he loved it. Like, you know, rolling start. And I remember what he said at the time. It's like, wow, Daddy, look at all the colours. And I remember, wow, you know, you've nailed it there, son, because it's when F1 was all grey, you know, all the grey cars. And I'm like, he just nailed it, you know, straight away. That's what F1 needs, a bit of colour. But yeah, not really football for him, but certainly computer games and Mario Kart. That's where he's at the moment.
You've got the perfect excuse now, because now you can say, well, I was planning on taking you to this year's Silverstone, but coronavirus, so here we are. That's how it is.
Yeah, we'll probably talk about this a bit more later on, but it has been devastating, really, for F1. My plans, everything, you know, of course, obviously, the bigger implication, the health of the nation and everything, all that sad news. But from my personal point of view, it's been very, very stressful going to Australia for 3 days. It was really uncomfortable, certainly being on that aeroplane with everyone wearing masks and gloves. I've never experienced anything like that before, and sort of a sense of you know, you knew it wasn't right at the time, and then of course the big scramble to get home. So it's been a bit strange. And while we're looking forward to it all coming back, it's obviously got to be under the right circumstances. So,
where were you when you found out that the race was off?
That was a tricky one. It was, what was it? Thursday night? We were playing football. We try and play football on like Thursday night, and 10 o'clock at night, we just had something to eat, just about to kick off. And then we all got the text that McLaren were about to withdraw from the race, and we were like, oh, God, you know, like, worst time. And then it was back to the hotel rooms, writing the stories, making phone calls. You know, at the time I had it on good authority that it was all off, but I wasn't too sure. I wasn't sure enough to book a flight home, so I was kind of a bit hesitant. And then I got told, oh, there'd be an announcement at 6 a.m. and I stayed awake. And then it was like, before you knew it, it was 9:30, and then I had the local news on, and the local governors were saying, go to the track. If F1 wants to cancel it, it's up to them. There's no news from F1, no news from the team. So there's rumours that Kimi and Seb had already left. But, you know, when's this news going to come out? And eventually it did. And, you know, it was a bit of a scramble to get to the airport and get home. So when it was confirmed, I was in the hotel just waiting for it just to be confirmed and announced. So. Yeah,
it must have been well frustrating and kind of confusing, you know, to deal with that kind of. It was such a obviously a very unique moment within. You take the whole history of F1 that happened, and me personally, I've got family within the McLaren team who works within, you know, in and amongst the pit crew, and I straight away, you know, without being able to get as much news, no matter how many sources you might use via the internet or whatever, I was straight away just texting them like, hey, so what's going on? And I think they were very much in the same boat. They didn't even really know what was the plan. They all went back to the hotel rooms waiting to be tested. I was thinking, wow, this is... I think that's where I feel it kind of clicked for everyone to see that Formula One, first race of the season, was on hold. And we're thinking, okay, this is a lot more serious than we realised. But nevertheless, we look like we're you know, heading in the right direction. And hopefully soon we will obviously have races. But typically for you... How would you break down a race weekend when there is a race? Like, what would you, as a journalist, how do you prepare for that?
Yeah, it all starts usually a few days before flying away. If we took an average race, because every single one's different in terms of when you get there, but if it's a flyaway, I tend to get there on a Tuesday, just so I've got the Wednesday to acclimatise. It's a European race, usually there on a Wednesday day or night, something like that. Hotel, obviously, check in, try and get my bearings. By then, I would have known if I'd have been successful with applications for interviews or had some ideas about where I wanted to go with a story. A lot of the time, it depends on what a certain Lewis Hamilton's been up to. Certainly, historically, he's certainly been a bit more active on social media. I used to also follow his jet and find out where he'd been. You can do that, and you know, just sort of know your subjects. You know, and obviously, do a little bit of a recap of what happened in the previous race and the talking points, and was let off, and that. So you always got sort of ideas. Then it comes around to Thursday, you get into the track, tend to get in fairly early because the media centres are busy, you can reserve a desk, and you tend to like to sit near the people that I like and whatnot, and you have to position yourself, believe it or not, if some of these press rooms are so duff, but you have to get within a seat where you can see the TV screens, because we fly around the world and we're watching on TV. And, you know, a lot of people stream it on their laptops with Sky commentary or whatever. So you might as well just be at home and you're in your bedroom doing it.
True.
The service, believe it, because we're sitting there watching this, you know, an old TV screen, somewhere like, you know, 100 yards away, no commentary. You know, the F1 graphic, you can barely see that. And it's kind of in the dark, you know, you're really in a little bit of a funny world, but that's Thursday, and then you get all your media time to get your interviews done, typed up, and then try and get away, maybe run the track on a Thursday night, and then of course Friday you're into practice, and the weekend's already rolling. So
it's pretty full. I'm normally the guy that sits at the back, just like closest to when they bring out the snacks and the fresh coffees. It's kind of my tack. I'm just sitting there, camera just plunked the table, charged batteries. I'm just like, right, cool, nothing's really happening.
There's lessons to this.
Exactly. There's different people in it for different things. Obviously, love this one, but you know, you got to enjoy what comes with it. And each race is always different. And you know, I've been so grateful that, and I think I share the same kind of feeling. I think of lots of, like you were saying, there's so many unpredictable things you could do with sports stars. And one story that I shared with the guys before I went out to Shanghai with motorsport.com and Shell, and we, you know, I knew I. You know, I admit that I kind of didn't have my head around exactly what we're doing. And normally these branded kind of presentations of drivers are very unpredictable. We put Charles Leclerc on an ice rink and he was racing an Olympic skier. And I was thinking, wow, that was like a year ago. And here we are now just stuck to watching these e-races. And it is what it is. But each race is so unique and different. And how many races do you think you've been to now? And do you normally look to go for a full calendar, or do you just pick out?
I'm glad I'm talking to you guys, because I'm not one of these nerds. We've got a few nerds in the press room that.
What tyre should we go for today, guys?
There's a lot of F1 nerds, as you can appreciate, certainly in the F1 press room, who never miss a race, and they have like this consecutive run of races. And I've never been one of those guys. I don't know how many races I've done. For the first 5 years, I did every single race, I think. And then I missed a couple. I think last year I missed five. You know, maybe ones which might have been tricky to get to, or for personal reasons, or Russia. Races which I don't...
Just Russia.
I don't need...
Just Russia.
The visas, oh my goodness.
It's one of those choices. But... sometimes it's cost saving. Sometimes it's the fact that I, you know, feel that access isn't, or it might be a case of, you know, Japan's a very difficult one to justify to go from a newspaper point of view, because the time difference, everything's over by about 7 o'clock in the morning, UK time. So, you know, you could literally roll out of bed. I could come down into my office. I could turn my computer on and everything's already there. The results are already done. You know, I'm not that guy. I would have got up and watched it on the TV, but I'm just saying you could, if you wanted to, cover it from home. Yeah. So, Japan I went to last year, and I've been to lots of times, so I like going to Japan. But there are obvious races that you can do remotely if you wished. But I prefer to do them all because I feel like I'm doing a proper job. So, for instance, all the ones that I'd booked this year, I think I had Bahrain missing from the first half of the season, but everything else was booked and paid for. So, we're waiting to see what happens next. So.
Yeah.
Right, so Ben, I need you to not break this illusion for me, because there's one race in particular where obviously these guys are been clowning me for it not being my favourite race and probably being my worst, which is Monaco. But the whole glitz and glam, the whole, you know, boat parties, yacht parties, all those things, yeah. Is it really like that?
Yeah. Let's say yeah. I mean, I don't want to shatter the illusion for you. People ask me what are the best races to go to, and I've just done a piece for our travel editor. Funny enough, it said, you know, normally it begins with an M. If your race begins with an M, book it and go, because Melbourne, Montreal, Monza, and Monaco are all fantastic races.
Really,
let's add that one in as well. The only one that's also good is Austin, and that hasn't got an M in it, but never mind. Monaco is fantastic for a number of reasons. The race is crap. You know, I can't get around that. It is a
procession. See, guys?
I will say last year's race was good, because Charles Leclerc crashing out and destroying his own floor is beautiful. I love the guy, but it's kind of anger personified. Well,
we've seen tantrums as well at Monaco. I mean, Lewis had a tantrum a few years ago, didn't he? With a pit stop call, and Senna as well has had a strop there. So it does throw up things, but it's not usually a very good race. The good thing about it is all the glitz and glamour that you talk about. You know, we tend to have a little bit of a unofficial competition on who can get on the biggest boat during the week.
You've got to tell me a story.
Probably the biggest boat that I ever got on there was Flavio Briatore's boat, and we watched the Champions League final there a few years ago.
Oh, that's it. I'm off.
Sat next to which is a bit weird. So yeah, that was when he was.
So what's it like being on one of those yachts, super yachts?
Yeah, it's surreal. Vijay Mallya used to have a very nice one there as well. I should drop in, but it's great. I mean, you have to take your shoes off. You have to leave them in a basket. And then once you're on board, it's fine. You know, you're just kind of a giant hotel, but lots of noise. You don't feel anything. It's just super fun, you know, and you always take the pictures. And then when you go through the phone the next day or the next month, whatever, you're like, oh, wow, you know, that was super cool. It was one of those moments where you just forget just how good it is. Sometimes I think as F1 journalists we forget just how lucky we are. We're in a very privileged position, not only to speak to these drivers but also to go to these locations to have access, plus the PR events that Matt was talking about earlier on. You know, you do get to go to weird things, you know, very strange things, and you know, drive weird cars, all that sort of stuff, you know, you just take for granted sometimes. So getting back to Monaco, the other reason I like it is that normal people go. Rather than going away to Greece for an all-inclusive for 2 weeks, they just save up the money and they go to Monaco for 4 days, spend exactly the same sort of money, but have a good time. And I like that. You know, I like seeing people enjoy themselves. And for mainly the people that go are just normal people. And I think that's what I like. They're normal people who have a passion for F1 and they come along and enjoy themselves. And where else can you go for a drink on the tarmac before a race? Do you know what I mean? It's so weird. Raskas just turns into like a disco pub until about 5 o'clock in the morning. And you know, that's like having a party on the pitch at Wembley before the cup final. Do you know what I mean?
So next year when we go, because we're gonna make sure we're going.
Dre's paying for us all.
Not so much of that, but I just want you to be our guide beforehand. Absolutely. To where to go, what to do, even what to wear. I've got all the shades ready, everything.
I'm in Ferrari red today.
that's the best thing. You can wear what you like. I mean, there are no rules. I mean, it really is just a very relaxed. It's also not that expensive. Once you forget about the race ticket, forget about staying in Monaco unless you're very lucky and get an Airbnb, which I've done in the last couple of years. You know, you do luck in if you get a good Airbnb. But if not, stay down the coast, stay in Italy if you have to, and get the train in, because you can do it on the, not let's not say on the cheap, but you can make it a little bit more affordable. less expensive, shall we say. So you can do it. And I think that's, as I say, that's what I like about it. People go the extra mile to go, save up their money and just enjoy themselves. And that's great. That's great.
I can say that's the thing. I can concur on the M's, especially. I was at Montreal last year. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a very affordable thing to be working there. But you could see from fans, it's a very affordable experience as well. And yeah, dress code wise, you can wear whatever you want. Like last year, it was so hot in Montreal that all the Canadian fans were walking around shirtless, confused why it was so warm. And they're thinking, hey, what's going on here? But for you, Ben, is there anything about Montreal for you that kind of sticks out as a Grand Prix, just on considering we've been there?
I love it. I love the fact it is like America, but not, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
I like
it's better.
It is, you know.
Yeah, it's just nice. I mean,
it's a good location geographically as well, where the track is, isn't it?
Yeah, if you're lucky and you stay in the French Quarter, then there's some really fantastic buildings and some lovely hotels and good bars and good beer and good food. Poutine, is probably the most fun food ever. It's chips and gravy and cheese curds. It sounds hideous, but it's bloody lovely. And
yeah. Really exactly. If they got it right up north, they should have got it right up north with the wording. It would have sounded more appetizing because it is absolutely. It was like a connoisseur because we went out there on a Monday. We were doing all the kind of media stuff with Ferrari, and then we stayed for an extra 2 days post race to do post production. So we thought, well, we've got the Airbnb, let's stick around here. So you think, you know, pretty much had all those days to be a connoisseur of poutine. I was like, is it poutine for lunch or is it poutine for dinner? Well, you can have both. It was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's it. We're going to do an F1 food show. Poutine leads the way.
Go for it.
So having been to all of these races, having done it since 2012, out of all that time you've done it for, who has been a current or post or whatever, who is the best personality you've interviewed, whether it's a driver, whether it's a team principal, whether they don't race anymore or what?
Yeah. Personalities. I used to like doing personality-wise, Vijay Mallya was always a fun character. Otmar, also at the same team, very fun guy. I like dealing with Christian Horner. I like dealing with Toto, which I think we'll talk about later. Jensen, we were okay. Kevin Magnussen, I like. Lewis, I have a like for, and we do get on fairly well, contrary to what people may well believe. Best personality. Difficult. Nicky Lauda, another one. Jackie Stewart. You know, there's some really, really good personalities there. I could probably do. Oh, you stumped me. I don't know. Let me think. I have to come back to you.
In that case, then, if you were to say, out of all of the drivers you've spoken to, who did you have the most fun chatting to? As if, like, if you were to say, like, anyone that you've interviewed, whether it's an old driver like Nicky Lauda or Jackie Stewart, who did you have, like, all the best interview, whether it was a pint in the pub or something like that, or like whether you saw them in downtown Montreal, for example, and you had 5 minutes with them in the pub, who, like, what was your best interview? It didn't have to be a person, but, like, your best interview.
Again, this is like I have a terrible memory for these things.
Now we're giving a journalist the hard questions. That's how it should be.
I tell you the best conversation I had with someone in F1 was Martin Whitmarsh when he was there, which is a real weird thing for me to say because we didn't really have a relationship. But I remember we were in a airport bar going back from South Korea, I think it was, and we were just talking just like normal people and just talking to him, and it was so refreshing just to talk about normal stuff. And he said to me, we were talking about cars and just normal stuff, and he was like, oh, I've got to go to Jakarta now, we're opening a new showroom now, and I've got to go here, and we're selling these many units and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, oh, all right. I mean, does anyone really need one of these supercars in their life? I've only got a Citroen DS in my place in France. So I don't go out in it to the tip. And I'm like, oh, wow, you know, like, it was just so nice just to talk to him away from all that F1-ness and to realise that he's only got one car that he actually owns, and that's the Citroen DS. It was quite refreshing. Other people down to earth, people like Paul Hembry, I used to really like talking to him. You know, just very, very straightforward. Otmar, another one who's very straightforward to deal with. Probably the best person, though, probably Bernie. I do mean that seriously, yeah. I mean, a group of us went out for dinner with him probably a few years ago now. We went to his favourite burger restaurant, and it was just really, really nice to talk to him. Now he's out of F1.
Yeah.
And such a diverse, you know, splits opinions all the way. People like him, hate him. Most people hate him, think that he ran F1 into the ground. But he just basically made it clear that he was working for someone, and that was to make F1 look more profitable than it was. And that's all he was doing. You know, he was doing the deals with Russia. We were going to these weird places. The things he was saying was deliberately bombastic. And it was all driving up the price of the sport, and then Liberty bought it. So, job, do you know what I mean? It's like, again, being a nice person to talk to.
It does make sense, though, especially when you step away from it. But out of the young drivers, I think we have, as a podcast, we love the young drivers, right? We're, you know, we love virtual e-racing, you know, we love Charles, we love Lando, George. There is, I think there's a perception that these guys are nice guys, right? And that they're gone are the days where there was direct rivalry on the track. These guys are just a bunch of, I wouldn't say kids, but they're a bunch of guys who just love having a going racing on Sunday. Yeah. Do you see that they are nice people? Do you believe it, having met them, having seen it? And also, do you feel that while they are nice people, there is that competitive streak in them, and they will go to bat on a Sunday and they will destroy each other?
I can confirm that all of them are nice. I think, you know, they've all come from very good backgrounds. They're all really nice guys. They've all known each other for donkey's years. They've all grown up, you know, doing the same thing. So very close, but do not for 1 second think that they won't try and put a move on one or the other, because they will. I think you know, the best example of this perhaps is Lando Norris and Carlos Sainz. And I know Carlos Sainz isn't one of the young guys that you're talking about, but Lando is. But they did have this relationship last year, which was very strange to have a team, and certainly a team like McLaren, to be so close and to be doing so much bromance stuff. It was all very, it was nice, it was good fun, and maybe it was because they weren't competitive that they could do it. But I did ask Lando in Abu Dhabi, and I've asked him since about that, and he said, look, don't think that we are mates, because there were moments last year when I was really, really angry. There was bits when I was gutted that he got the podium. You know, we did all the photos and stuff, but I was crossed. I wanted it to be me, you know, and I thought, you know, good on you, because he has got that inside of him, and he has got that ruthlessness. I mean, getting back to that sim race at the weekend, and okay, he was the victim, but then he did have that he did have that shunt with that guy Pagano, didn't he, on the couple of laps before? So he almost caused that himself, you could say. You know, so he has got that in him, and that's great, because they need to have that, because, you know, if they're both going into a corner, then one of them's, you know,
coming out on top,
come off behind. So you know, that's good that they've got that relationship.
So just on before we get into the really juicy stuff that, you know, I'm very eager to get into, what would you say, like, now, like, because obviously I feel that because Liberty is obviously taken over, obviously racers now are allowed to be able to have this social media, you get to know them a little bit more. How do you, from your point of view, because obviously from a fan's point of view, it's great.
Yeah.
From your point of view, is it more tricky because everyone's got so much more access?
Yeah, people won't give two hoots about what I've got to say, because from the fans' point of view, what Liberty are doing, the Drive to Survive stuff, the F1 TV, the Will Buxton stuff, all that Twitter show, people are going to lap it up and love it. But the flip side is that it's costing time for me with those drivers. You know, Liberty Media are a media company, but they don't understand traditional British media, which was print media. And okay, maybe I'm a bit of an old stick when it comes to things like that, but I do think that the magazines and the written press, and I'm going to include online in that because obviously we have an online site as well. So yeah, I think that traditional press, written press, are losing out as a result of the ideas that Liberty have. So I am often at loggerheads with them, fighting for what I think. You know, I don't think that press conferences should be televised. Okay, I get stick. I really don't care anymore because that's just part of the job. But I don't think it's fair that certainly young journalists who make the effort to go to Japan, Singapore, other side of the world, wherever, they shouldn't be feeling afraid to ask questions because of being vilified on the internet, because they have a right to ask the questions. That's what they're there to do. That's what their editors have paid them to go there to do, ask the questions. And sometimes they are awkward questions. So televising it and broadcasting it live into people's homes, bedrooms, you know, that's not right, in my opinion. I think that there should be some sort of embargo that allow that those guys who do the donkey work, pay the money to go there, freelance or staff, they should have at least a bit of a heads up to be able to type up their quotes, their stories, and publish before they've got back to their desks and seen it already running there. I think that's, you know, that's a massive issue for me, and I get incredibly frustrated when I've gone there, done the donkey work, and I sit down and, you know, I always joke F1fansinmybedroom.com have already got it running online, and it's like, Jesus, you know, like, how am I going to stop this? There's nothing I can do because I go to Liberty, and that's exactly what Liberty want. They want the digital numbers, they want the eyeballs, so I'm going against them. So it is a little bit frustrating. I know they're doing the right thing in their own mind, but it's at a cost, and I think that there's a balancing act that needs to happen. We need to keep some of the content back for ourselves. In order to do that, we need the teams to be cooperative, and we need the drivers. At the moment, the drivers are having a bit too much to say in terms of the media that they do. And ultimately, that's costing us time, which is a shame.
So like on the new, you know, way of media that Liberty have actually introduced, obviously, we had the documentary Drive to Survive. Now, obviously, from a fan's point of view, I know, I'm sure from a journalist's point of view, that you're getting to see little things that you don't normally get to see, conversations. You can kind of read in between the lines a little bit more about the teams. But obviously for you, because obviously you're featured in that, Star.
Yeah.
And
episode 4, go to 33 minutes, you'll find this guy.
So I'm going a bit darker.
Yeah, because people are going to think you're hiding otherwise. So on that, obviously, you know, you asked a question that you normally do. You obviously, you're not aware of what, there's loads of cameras in there.
Yeah.
So you asked a question to Toto. You know, he didn't take it too well, but obviously that's probably just a normal day. But obviously, because it's on a documentary, it just become a blown up thing. Yeah. What was the reaction to that? You know, when you actually saw it first, what was your reaction? And then B, like, what's happened to, you know, what was the fans like? I heard that people were coming at you.
Yeah, a few trolls. I mean, I do get a lot of trolls. I'll talk about this one first, and then remind me about the first part. I do get a lot of trolls, partly because the organisation I work for. I mean, press is a very sensitive matter. People have preconceived ideas. Some people like the sun, a lot of people don't like the sun. Some people like the Mao, a lot of people don't like the Mao. You know, everyone has these ideas. So it's kind of difficult to change those. And they have preconceptions about me as a person. They don't know me, never met me. They just assume me that I'm, you know, just not a nice guy. So unfortunately, when it got round to that Drive to Survive episode, perhaps I've gone a long way to confirming their suspicions that I am just like they already assumed. I'm not a fair guy. I was looking for a headline, and I'm scum of the earth, and Toto was right to put me down. But I don't know. I think I was right to ask the question. I think it goes against the backdrop of a team being uber confident. You know, the outfits and everything that went into that weekend. So much happened in that race. And of course, it was all being captured live on a TV show, which they'd refused to do the previous year. So it was it's only fair to be called out in that instance in the same way as I'm called out if I make a mistake in my articles. I felt that Mercedes made a mistake. They took their eye off their ball. And I think Toto's reaction is as much frustration at the situation as it was my question. So we've spoken
That's
about
just it. A normal thing, isn't it? That's just like, you have that every race with every different team principal.
It happens in every race. It happens at football matches. It happens, you know, if a player as an absolute stinker and gets sent off, then you ask him about it. If a manager, if his team's been hammered 5-0, you have to ask the question. Because if I didn't ask the question, my editor would say, well, did you ask him about that? And then, oh no, sorry, I didn't think. I mean, what would they think of me? I mean, it goes back to the whole you're being sent there to ask the questions. That's what I do. Do you know what I mean? I think that, you know, there should have been more people asking those questions, in my opinion, because that was the talking point around that weekend.
Do you feel that you've been, because I do want to say, I feel like from my perspective, I work with journalists on a daily basis. I know there is always going to be times where they ask a difficult question, but that's just the way the world works. That's how you get news. That's how you get headlines, because everyone just went with what everyone said. It's not really news. But I feel that you what you said earlier about there is a lot of young journalists now that are afraid to ask questions because they see Toto as a powerhouse. Toto doesn't lose, and therefore for Toto to lose, something must have gone drastically wrong that they don't want to ask about. But I feel you were vilified a lot more because no one is asking those questions, and it made you stand out a lot. Do you feel that that's right, or do you still feel that maybe from the Netflix documentary, we didn't see the seven other people asking difficult questions, we just saw you?
No, there wasn't seven different people, unfortunately. It was just me. that's happened a few times, trust me. I mean, it's one of those things. Yeah. But getting back to your point about the young people asking questions, I do think that is an issue. People do see Toto as a powerhouse, to use your phrase. But I also see a lot of people on the internet, these trolls that call me names, assuming that everything that Mercedes tell you is the truth. And you can believe it or not, you know, you can investigate and you can have your own opinions. But so many people just say, I've seen it so many times on the internet, well, Mercedes said this, so it must be true. And it's like, well, is it true? Because like, I know something or someone says something different and my job is to find out if it's true or not. But the dangerous situation is if you have these young journalists who are too afraid to ask those awkward questions, you have too many people believing the narratives of the team. So if we bring it full circle at the moment and we've got races behind closed doors, Liberty are controlling all the media because we're not allowed, all the narrative is going to be how great it is to be back. There won't be anyone holding anyone to account on the testing process for the coronavirus. Is it right that you're being tested when our key workers aren't being tested? You know, there's not going to be any of that, which is actually the talking point, the stuff that I would go and find out. Do you think this is fair? You know, your mum works in the A&E in, I don't know, St George's in London, and like, you know, you're being tested, you're putting tyres on an F1 car. Do you think that's fair? And she's not. I mean, like, that's the sort of stuff that we're going to miss. It's all going to be very polished, very sanitised. And the moment that you start losing journalists that ask the awkward questions, whether you like me or not, that's the danger, because you're going to end up with a soft sport which is not going to be representative. It's all going to be very fake, very stage managed. It's all going to be edited heavily. It's all going to be on the director's cutting room floor, and we're all going to be living in a Netflix world where, you know, we all know F1, we've seen how that program has been edited, where they've taken bits from certain races and pieced it together, and you look at it and think, hang on a minute, that's not Montreal, that's so-and-so. And it's been edited that way. And that's unfortunately where we're going to be if we don't have people of the press there asking those questions, and also independent members of the press as well, rather than press officers or people that are too afraid to ask those tricky ones. So that's the thing. It's a dangerous place to be.
So for... go as what you said, the race is behind doors where we're going to basically... almost like censorship. Right, which I'm not saying it is censorship, but it is kind of, it's getting close to where we're having a controlled narrative.
It could be controlled, couldn't it? I mean, who knows what's gonna happen? You know, God forbid it all goes off fine. But do you really expect there to be a report of how many tests there will be, if there's a positive test, and that is the information that might not come out, and that is my fear, that we'll end up with a sanitized version of events.
So for a weekend like that, would you, and I don't know if you do have any, but would you rely on sources within teams, within kind of, whether it's within the FIA or anything like that, yeah, to get that news?
Yeah, you'd have to rely on the teams. And you know what? I am going to trust the FIA because I've got nowhere else to go to. So it's an FIA-run event. I like the guys at the FIA. I like the people at Liberty as well. So I will be talking to them, and I'm sure they will be clear. But I'm just saying, for argument's sake, I'm not saying they're not going to tell the truth, but I'm just saying it would be possible for it to happen. And I think that that's the dangerous situation. And I'm not one of these guys saying that media should be coming back, because I don't think we should. I think in order to get this race behind closed doors, I think it would be a good thing, assuming it's safe to do so. And there's no need for us to be there. We can cover it remotely, providing we have sort of access. We have a Zoom video conference or something that we could do, and we can ask those questions. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm spoon-fed press releases and told this is what's happened when I've already watched it on the TV, and then not have the ability to ask a question.
Just really quickly, because you know, we've got a lot of other things we want to pick your brain about, is obviously, you know, we from an outsider point of view, like, you know, if you're meeting Toto for the first time, because he's such a tall, strong looking, powerful, yeah, financially and in the sport guy, like, who, you know, who's your top like three people that are tricky that you think, oh god, I have to interview them? I don't know if you can say it, but like, yeah, is there people that you're like, oh, I'm not really going to get much from these guys?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to my wife a lot about this. She always says, oh, do you get nervous? I don't get nervous. So I'm not afraid of doing interviews and asking questions. And you know, I've met big footballers, and you have to ask those tricky ones sometimes. I don't really go into anything not expecting to get an answer, because I've already got my questions down, and I hope that they answer the questions truthfully, honestly, and give me a line. I mean, there are certain interviews you go to and you think, oh, she's not going to give me anything, but you never know, it might throw up something, you know. Drivers down the back of the grid, there might be something there, or you listen in the back, and you know, it's just one of those things. But certainly not with I don't get frightened. Toto is a big character, but we also have a good relationship. I talk to him a lot. I also know his wife fairly well through Formula E, and we were laughing about that in Mexico, because well, I should say before that, I was at the Mercedes, you know, they did the car launch in the RAC club. I forget when it was now, February time. It was before testing. And Toto said, oh, that Netflix thing, you remember we had that row in Germany? I was like, yeah. He goes, oh, it's, you're good to know, you're in, you're going to be a star. And I was like, oh, great.
You're like, oh, God, no. But you forget it, because you've probably moved on, because this is like, and this is what I would probably say to, like, as newbies to the world of Formula One, you know, there's no point in being like, I think there's a difference between fans of the team and being fanatics, where you believe everything that you know the team is telling you. I think that it's important to have people like yourselves, and obviously from another point of view, from ourselves, from a lighter point of view, but you know, you're going to ask the questions that give us content. So, so therefore you are, for us, you really are important. So so lay off my mate, Ben.
also to be fair, we only saw that like 2 minutes or whatever it was in the show. And then Rolls jumped on you and said, that's a disgusting question, whatever they said. But what you've just said is that Toto came up to you and had a laugh about. So what they don't see is that side.
I know, but people don't see the relationship they have, and this is the other thing, right? You know, we obviously have spoken a few times about it, and as I said, I've spoken to Susie when it was at Formula E race. She goes, oh, that was you. I was like, oh yeah, you know, we watched it, it's quite funny, you know, we thought you did all right. And I was like, well, okay, well, we'll see. But I mean, but
that's the thing, you have that relationship with Toto, so it opens the door for those questions. Yeah. I can imagine someone that doesn't know Toto, that would be quite a difficult question to ask, but it's down to people like you that have got that relationship to be like, come on. answer a question.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it. And that's what people don't understand.
And just lastly, I mean, just my personal opinion, is that I don't think that question was anything really, as obviously we get to sit in now press conferences and we see these types of questions being asked all the time. What I don't know whether you can comment on this, in that same documentary when they were going after Alex Albon's mum,
I
thought that was distasteful. I'm glad it obviously wasn't yourself asking that, but I just thought, like, why, just from another point of view, like, why was that a story? Why was that something even to write about?
I know the journalist that was doing the interview. We all know the story about Alex and his mum. Red Bull have obviously tried to deal with it in a manner to say, please don't ask about that situation because he's not comfortable. And there's so much of it already out that it's kind of gone. It's been done. There's no need to go down that route. You know, I would argue in that case, he is free to ask whatever question he wants. And there was certainly the implication that Alex was happy to answer the questions. I think that is what wound the journalist up. He was saying, you know, like, he wants to answer. Everyone's going to be asking if you could get it all done and dusted. And then Alex was sort of like rabbit in the headlights. I think we also need to remember that he's only been F1 very, very shortly. And not had the exposure to certain hard-nosed journalists. So perhaps he was a little bit caught out. I think it was slightly unfortunate, but, I mean, you know, the journalist is there to ask the questions. The press officer did a really good job in shutting it down. I think it was a perfect...
Yeah, he did. I know. He did that with a quickness. You know, like, that was...
Exactly. Both of them did their jobs. You know, he went to ask the question, the press officer shut it down, and the driver come out of it with his reputation intact and didn't have any embarrassing story about his mum in the paper. So it was all fine. You know, it all worked out perfectly, I guess you could say.
Again, another thing you don't see is that that press officer and that journalist probably have a very, very good relationship. So, you know, people watch these shows and they go, oh, that journalist is a bit of a dick. Yeah. Or, you know, that press officer was really quite rude. Actually, that press officer is doing his job and that journalist is doing his job. Mm. And that's based on a relationship they have. So it's good to, from your perspective, it's good to see that you respect the press officer doing his job. Because I know from being one, often you kind of think journalists look at you as an annoyance. But actually, it's nice to see that, you know, from your perspective, they are worth having around.
I think the way it is that from another point of view, I think that people just was upset because they want questions. Your question was, I still perplexed me why anyone had a problem with that. I think, but if it's seemingly nothing to do with the actual race, and because Alex Albon's such a nice guy, you know, obviously it was just like hit hard. And then obviously it's a documentary because obviously they put the music to it. So this guy, might as well just put devil horns on the journalist as well. Don't worry, they're going to draw it on yours next time. As well.
I mean, the thing is, we do have this relationship with the drivers as well. That's what people also forget. Like, I've been dealing with Vettel for all these years now. And, you know, we speak a little bit about, he's got an old Vespa that he's rebuilding. And I used to have a Vespa, which I would rebuild and do stuff. So we would talk a little bit about that. And so, you know, we do know each other. So when I pull him up in after he crashed into Lewis in Baku, and people say, oh, you can't ask those questions. Yeah, you can, because, like, I'm not like some random man on the street that's just accosted him. You know, I'm there doing it, and he knows who I am. It's not like we're strangers. The same for Lewis, you know. I know Lewis, and I write things about him when I jump on him when he's done things that I don't think are right, and when he's done good stuff, I write about that. I mean, a perfect example was... you know, when he came out last October and he did the hypocritical, people were saying he was a hypocrite for saying, give up meat, become a vegan, save the planet. And then people were saying, oh, yeah, but you just drive around in circles and burn petrol and fly your private jet. You're a massive hypocrite. And I don't happen to believe that that's true. I think that he shouldn't be criticised for that because it's his opinion. He's changing his life. You know, he's sold the jet. He's being more environmentally friendly, and he's a sports star of an opinion, and, you know, they're rarer than anything. They're Aaron and Hensteeth, because he's not afraid to speak his mind. And I wrote a piece saying, don't jump on him. Let's applaud him for having an opinion, being man enough to stand up, like he did in Melbourne. You know, no other driver was prepared to speak out. And then Lewis said, you know, it's ridiculous we're here. We shouldn't be here. Cash is king. Do you remember that comment? You know, like he was very outspoken. He'd become like an elder statesman. And, you know, I was like, good on you. And anyway, he pulled me aside after writing the initial piece and said, look, thanks for doing that. And I said, you don't have to thank me. I'm just writing. Well, I don't do it to suck up. I do it because I happen to agree with your opinion. And if I don't agree with your opinion, then I'd say that as well. So, you know, we do have relationships. What I'm trying to say in a very long way is that we do have relationships with team bosses, drivers, people within teams. So it does have a bearing on the questions and the way that we ask. So, you know, if people may think that I was being out of order, but I don't think I was. I think Toto sees it now as funny, and we've all moved on.
Don't worry, we're going to get the T-shirts printed. Leave Ben alone.
I want one. Send it my way. Is there a body work, Ben, that, as we're winding down, that you are most proud of? It might be a tough question, or is there a number of articles or interviews that come to mind?
Not so much articles. Certainly getting to where I am today, I'm very proud of. I think, you know, going from that 7-year-old me that I started talking about at the start of this video, you know, people, a lot of things, why do you work for the Sun? You know, or, you know, I sat down at a wedding a few months ago, and someone said, oh, I can't talk to you, you work for them. And I'm like, well, I mean, you know, you're entitled to your opinion, as we've been saying all the way through this. You know, people can believe what they want. I'm working, in my eyes, for the leading sports paper in the UK. You know, we sell more copies than anyone else. Our online site is now most visited sports site out of all the papers. And it's like, you know, we're kind of leading the way, and we do tend to have a little bit of fun along the way as well. So I'm proud of where I'm at, where I've got to. In terms of my stories, I'm proud that I'm often, I don't get caught out is one of the things I will say. I'm usually on a story and follow it all the way through. I never open the paper or rivals papers and think, oh God, I missed that one. I really should have got that one. You know, there's none of that. I think that's a case of keeping your ear to the ground, checking on your days off, seeing what everyone else is doing, paying attention, speaking to people. So I think, again, another long answer to a very short question. Most proud of is the fact that I've got to where I am, and I'm still on the top of my game, if you like, in terms of covering the sport. I don't feel like I'm missing stuff. I think that I was on top of the corona crisis and the outbreaks, the cancellation in China, all the way through to the plans for Austria. I think we've led the way. From a news point of view, we're leading the way on all of that, the Austrian plans and sort of the Silverstone doubleheader and Silverstone opening up their medical facilities for NHS and all that sort of stuff. So little stories that are in the back of my mind, you know, I'm pleased that I'm doing that. So, yeah.
And reality is that, look, if the Sun was the super enemy of the world, well, guess what? You wouldn't get the access in such a professional sport.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, you know, I do work closely with the guys at Mercedes and certainly Lewis. I've done lots of bits and pieces with Monster Energy in the past. And certainly if they did see me as the devil without the horns, then I wouldn't have that access. I wouldn't be invited into Mo's home. I wouldn't be allowed to sit in a car with him and do a hot lap. You know, that wouldn't exist. But I am and I continue to do so. So, yeah.
Did you on your hot lap, because these guys keep on taking the mick out of me? I have never screamed so much in my life. So was you a fellow screamer, or was you playing it cool?
No, I played it cool. My first proper hot lap was Brands Hatch in a Ford Capri. So that was my screaming moment.
My God,
Ford Capri. Did the rear axle fall off?
Yeah, I know. It's pretty.
I would not trust that at all. No way.
We come off the tarmac and not into a big bump. But then I've been lucky. I mean, I've done hot laps with Lewis, as I said. That was one of my first ones, actually. Fantastic. 4LC around the Top Gear track. We've done Mercedes-Benz World a couple of times since as well. George Bianchi, when he was a reserve driver at Force India, we've done those. I think the scariest, though, was invited to a Mercedes-Benz celebration, 125 years of motorsport, last year at Silverstone, and going around that track with Stoffel driving a DTM car. That's pretty next level, actually. Those things are absolutely brutal. And
was you air braking?
Yes. And then there was this really horrible moment when the engineers, this is the first time he was going to drive this car, and like he obviously went full chat, and it was just like Gary Paffett was there and said, like, take care of it because I won the title in this last year. And I'm like, Jesus, you know, like I've worked all the way up as well. So I've gone from like the GT car, like an old DTM car, to the GT car, and it was all progressing. So this was the fastest thing that was going to go around the track that day. So I was a little bit bricking it, had the helmet on and everything, and you squeeze yourself in, you know, it's a nightmare to get in. And one of the engineers said, if you go on straight, button number 4, if you turn it anti-clockwise, you get a boost of power. But only on the straight. And I was like, oh, why do you have to tell him that? Like, honestly, no, I'm breaking it. I don't need this. So we go out, and the noise, the vibration, and everything. I can't even see where we're going. You know, it's like this, hating every second of it because it's just like, ugh. And then I can see him on the straight, and he turns this thing to number 4, and the windscreen wipers go like this. And he's just like this to the guys. Can't believe that. And they said, did you? What? Oh, yeah, you did. You turned it to number 4. Number 4 was the windscreen wipers. It was nothing to do with power. So of course, it was a private joke that they had. I was obviously bricking myself as well, and Stoffel fell for it. So it was quite funny all around, really. But
well, we'll see with these two here. We'll see how cool they are, because they seem to think that it's a walk
like
in the pot.
I'll be like Kimmy. I'll just be sitting there, glum face, like, cool.
If you've never done it, it is really a fantastic experience.
I think the biggest thing...
The Pirelli hot laps, don't they? That's good fun.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is because I drive quite fast as well. So, and, you know, I'm just used to it, so I'll be fine.
Well, excuse me.
The final last words until I actually cry my eyes out in the front seat.
There's a difference to driving fast and being a passenger in a fast car.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you will be... You will be reaching for that brake pedal, and it won't be there.
It's the corners. It's the corners. No, there's no, there's. I don't understand how anyone could get used to going around a corner at about 90 miles per hour. Like, that is not that. You just feel crazy, you're just flying around. So anyway, I will stop moaning.
last question, Ben. Obviously, this season is a bit of a weird one. Almost a write-off from a media perspective. But what's next for you? Are you going to continue covering F1? Are you going to potentially cover other sports or move towards... I know, obviously, Formula E is coming up more. Are you going to move that way? Or do you feel like F1's where you want to be?
I'm very happy doing what I'm doing at the moment, and that is a bit of everything. I do football over winter when the F1's season usually stops, which I love, because you get back in and seeing all the old faces, and sort of it's a test, you know, like squads have all changed since I've been doing it last, and you get a team sheet, you don't know who any of these guys are, and you're like, wow, you know, figuring it out. But I enjoy that and getting up to speed and doing the research and that. I love getting into the pre-season testing, the F1 season, I do love, but I also love doing the Formula E as well from a different point of view. I don't think there is a conflict between the two. I think that they can run simultaneously. So I enjoy...
How relaxing is Formula E in comparison? I went to Berlin E Grand Prix, and wow, a completely...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a completely different beast, but wow, what a relaxed vibe that is.
It's relaxed, but what's nice is that everyone's pulling in the same direction. So there's a level of competitiveness, but they're not looking to turn each other over at every opportunity, financially, points-wise, whatever it may be. Everyone's pushing in the same direction, and that is for the benefit of the championship. So you've seen the way that those cars have got quicker and quicker, and then when they start bringing out these like wireless chargers for the phone, that they're going to be doing those. So there'll be pit stops, pulling in 30 seconds, batteries re-topped up, and they're back out again. And I think the moment that they crack stuff like that, then it will be a serious championship, and you'll start seeing a difference. But yeah, I like doing that. I'm very happy doing F1. I think Liberty are doing a lot of good. As I mentioned before, I think that I've got to fight my corner and I need some of my colleagues to help me fight that, just in terms to protect some exclusivity that I think that people who pay to be there deserve, rather than just farming out all the content immediately out onto TV. So it's not what fans want to hear, but it is what we want to hear. And yeah, if I'm not there, then you won't get anyone to laugh at in your drive to survive.
I'll tell you what, Ben, we will make that offer of covering Miami next year, fingers crossed it goes ahead, for you as well. You know, it's not a problem. You know, we'll wear the T-shirts as well. You know, whatever it takes, it's not a problem. You know, we can guide you around Miami. You guide us around Monaco.
Yeah, sounds like a good deal.
Thank you so much for your time. Honestly, you've been amazing. So, Ben, let me just make sure I get your socials right, so all your fans can get in contact with you. It's at Ben J Hunt. Yeah. And obviously with us, obviously, at Verge Mag, I'm forgetting all my stuff now, at Verge Mag Online on Twitter, at Verge Mag on Instagram, at Alternative Sport, which is our new platform. And on Twitter, we are at Alt Sport. See, we've been really busy. This quarantine is getting us. We're working harder than ever now. Yeah, we're having our own team car soon.
I think we're all being a bit, you know, busy. I mean, in terms of my working day's different. Not going to races means you've got to phone people up and you've got to start doing the old school thing, you know, the old digging around the subjects. And there's still news stories out there, and eSports has given us stuff to write about at all. So you wouldn't have thought that, would you, like 6 months ago, that we'd be talking about eSports
We're going to give you a story that you don't know about. Did you know that Pierre Gasly listens to Candy Shop before he races?
I didn't know that, no.
You see? See? You're welcome. That's one. That one's for free.
Dre's trying to get himself a new job.
See? That's it. I'm going to leave these two behind. It's just me and you, Ben. We're gone. All right. Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate your time. Thanks for listening in on Spotify, so forth, and all the other good platforms. Thank you for your time. And please keep on tuning in and appreciate your love. Peace.